Okay, I'm going to go ahead and get us started so that we're on time today. Again, sorry about the delay last week. Appreciate you guys being patient with us on that. We are so appreciative of the fact that Dr. Thistlethwaite has been willing to give this lecture series on Warhol during the run of the exhibition in conjunction with this TCU class. We really appreciate the students making the trek over here. Hope it's been worth your while getting to go into the galleries and spend time with the actual work. And the lectures have been wonderful. Today, Mark is going to close with an unending 15 minutes, Warhol's legacy. And I think we're going to see him at his brightest and best today. From what I understand. No, Mark Thistlethwaite.
Thanks, Terry. And thanks for working with us and letting us come in and use the museum. It's as you mentioned, it's always great to see works of art in person. It makes all the difference, particularly this exhibition, which I think a lot of people are surprised by how large Warhol's paintings are, and particularly the Last Supper paintings are really gigantic compositions, which is always a little bit surprising. And you can also see in some of the paintings where there is paint on the surface that just doesn't show up in reproduction. So it's always a bonus, obviously, if not an absolute necessity, to see the works of art in person. As Terry mentioned, today I want to talk about Warhol's unending 15 minutes. I actually at one point thought I would do a 15-minute talk, and that would be my claim to fame, and people would remember that and so forth, but ended it. So it's going to be slightly longer to maybe disappointing you. Warhol is really remarkable. I mean, the exhibition, I think, gives you an indication of the breadth of his work. But throughout his career, he was, again, a painter, he was a filmmaker, he was involved in music, he was involved in advertising, he became a celebrity spokesperson, he ran a magazine. It was just sort of on and on and on. He really was someone who, for all the laconic attitude that he expressed and his sense of, as we were talking about last week, you know, it's just, it's on the surface, there's nothing else. There was an awful lot going on. And it, in a way, it's continued unabated. I mean, it really is quite remarkable that he dies in 1987, and yet it seems like Warhol and Warhol-related objects and interest in Warhol books are continually coming out. Exhibitions are continually being organized on him. So as this cover from Art News from 2002 says, much more than 15 minutes. Now, that doesn't please everyone, obviously. Warhol always had his detractors, but it certainly does indicate his ongoing celebrity, which in some ways was his ultimate goal, and he really achieves it. I like the subtitle of this cover, The Rise and Rise of Andy Warhol. When the fall will occur, we'll have to see. That phrase, the 15 minutes, refers to a comment he made that in the future, everyone in the world will be famous for 15 minutes. And in a sense, the internet is sort of proving that to be true, and YouTube is proving that to be true, something he did not anticipate, although who knows, maybe he did. There's a secret diary somewhere that, or in one of those 612 archival boxes in the Andy Warhol Museum, there's his predictions of the future. But that phrase, everyone's going to be famous for 15 minutes, or you'll have your 15 minutes of fame, really almost from the time it was uttered in the 60s, has resonated in a variety of ways. When I was in graduate school in Philadelphia, in 1974, there was an artist who set up a stage in front of the art building with a microphone and speakers and a banner, and it was called Your 15 Minutes. And it was just, you could get up and do whatever you wanted to do for 15 minutes, and that was your claim to fame. So right at the beginning, and continuing today, so it's not surprising that in visual culture, particularly popular visual culture, we're continually running into these kind of references to that. This is, the caption reads, "An unwelcome 15 minutes of fame for Dan Rather in 60 Minutes." This is a illustration that appeared in the New Yorker magazine in 2004, had to do with a controversy over what turned out to be not accurate documents dealing with President George W. Bush and the Air National Guard that Rather had promoted as being factual and aired on 60 Minutes, and there were huge apologies that were necessary, and this idea that, you know, it brought all this attention to him in a negative way. So the 15 minutes of fame is negative, and as you can see perhaps in the image, he's about to step into this opening in the street and drop down. Or this rather bizarre, I mean, it's like Warhol's range of works and his activities, the images that play off of this are sometimes equally bizarre. Death is saying to Fidel Castro in 2001, "Listen, about your 15 minutes of fame, the clock is ticking," as it were. Or, "What if I had my 15 minutes and didn't notice it?" You know, the great fear we all have, like, whoops, I missed it. And or the Star-Telegram in 1989 ran this full-page ad for a contest they were sponsoring. "Everyone is funny for 15 minutes." And if you were to write a joke or write a joke that was a favorite of yours that was 100 words or less, and they thought it would take you 15 minutes to do, and that's why they're using that phrase. And they attributed and paraphrased and apologized to Andy Warhol for the use of it. And then this one said, "In the future, everyone's going to stop talking about being famous for 15 minutes," which in fact doesn't seem to be the case. Again, it's become a phrase that has very much entered into popular lexicon, and it's something you hear repeatedly. And at some point, probably it'll be forgotten who actually said it. It'll become so embedded within it. And it's spun off, not only in the variety of cartoons like this, but you'll find references to it. For example, this is having to do with philanthropy and people giving and so forth, but they want to set up the idea that there's new fame to be gained, a celebrity status for the everyday donor. And so playing off the notion of fame, which is bringing up Warhol for the illustrator here, who then shows the Campbell soup can with a slot that, of course, is indicating you would drop money into it, that you would donate. So that, you know, two of the one would be, I guess, an iconic statement by Warhol of the fame for 15 minutes, and then the iconic image that we talked about before early on, the Campbell soup can, which, again, like the phrase 15 minutes of fame, is really ubiquitous within our culture today. And it's really, you know, just stepping back and thinking about it, it's really a remarkable achievement, in a sense, that Warhol accomplished just by contributing that to popular culture, besides everything else that he did. His style, which varied throughout his career, and in fact he made the comment in the early 60s, mid-60s, you know, wouldn't it be great if everyone could work in a different style, that you could always be changing styles and you wouldn't be considered an abstract expressionist or a minimalist or a pop artist or photorealist, but, you know, your style was always changing. But one aspect of his style that has been very influential that we talked a bit about last time in terms of advertising, because it does relate to kind of grid structure that you find in advertising in the 1940s and 50s. But when you see it today, when you see it in the 90s and in the 21st century, it's coming out of Warhol. So, you know, juxtaposing the 36 images of Ethel Skull on the left with images from the Dallas Morning News in 2001 of Janet Reno, an article about her, then Attorney General of the United States, and very much except for the color set up, and obviously the detail, but set up like the structure of Warhol, using that grid, using that photo booth strip notion. And this occurs over and over and over again, in particularly in newspaper editorial illustrations like this. It really becomes, again, part of the visual vocabulary that comes into place as a result of Warhol. And again, it's want to stress, it's Warhol's influence. It's not Charles Coffin, who does a cover for Vogue magazine in 1954 with this kind of setup. It's really Warhol who really popularizes it, makes it something that people recognize and want to adapt. And part of it has to do in that it is Warhol and it's known, but also I think it's something that we touched on before. It's an image, it's a way of constructing an image of a person that seems really appropriate for our time. It has a kind of kinetic quality, sort of a cinematic quality about it, with these various images of a person, which indicate that, like everyone, you know, Janet Reno has different moods, different roles, different presentations that she is making for us, and we all have that. And this is a way of, in a sense, suggesting that, if not encapsulating it, bringing it forward, that we are very relativistic in a sense, in that our persona is ongoing, is changing, so forth. And you find it, as I say over and over again, on the right is from 1994, the New York Times Magazine. This is an article about criminals, and it's showing criminals from the 1940s, as well as Charles Manson and others. But again, set up very much like a Warhol composition, in this case with the monochromatic color changes that happen in this, moving towards a kind of sepia and then black and white, and varying it as he does in the 16 Jackies or other compositions from the early 1960s. This is, I think, particularly interesting that it's used for this article on criminals, because as we were talking about last week, at the World's Fair in New York in 1964, for this New York State Pavilion, Warhol created this very large composition, Most Wanted Men, that was based on the actual wanted posters or mugshots of these individuals. And in a sense, he's very much anticipating something 30 years later, something that in 1964 is essentially banned. He had to paint it out, and ultimately it was covered over even before the fair officially opened. And then it becomes something that is part of the Sunday paper and part of newspapers and something we see every day. So, you know, there's a huge kind of change that's occurred in the acceptance of what he did, and in large part, of course, it was driven by the subject matter, which is what raised the problem, as well as the context in which it was being shown. There have been a number of artists that have been very much affected by Warhol. You see a lot of illustrations on record cover albums, for example, CD album covers and so forth, that replicate the Warhol look. One artist who in the 90s, beginning in 92, and then at least till 99, I don't think she's working in this manner anymore, but Deborah Cass is an artist who really got hold of Warhol and did a whole series of paintings between 92 and 99 called the Warhol Project. And they're works that are very much indebted to, in fact, really appropriate Warhol's work rather directly, although she's makes substitutions with his subjects. For example, Barbara Streisand becomes the gold Barbara rather than the gold Marilyn that he created, that's in Museum of Modern Art in New York today. And then on the right, Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man from 1994, that shows Deborah Cass herself striking the pose that Warhol struck in that work of 64 and also 66. So replicating it really very closely. But for her, that replication, it's operating on a couple of levels. One is that sense of parody that I think is embedded in pop art that is not funny, ha-ha parody, or even witticism, but the idea of replicating something with the idea that in doing that, you're calling attention to it in a different way. You're getting a kind of critical distance on it and a different critical view on it by replicating it. And I think that's what she's concerned with. She also is very much concerned with herself as a woman artist, as a Jewish artist, as a lesbian artist. And she brought that to bear in this imagery. So it's always very much part of her subject matter, part of her content. And she basically does a lot of paintings of Barbara Streisand, who becomes sort of the Jewish Marilyn Monroe for Deborah Cass. Warhol, interestingly, as far as I know, never did an image of Barbara Streisand, which is also of interest to Deborah Cass. Why would that be the case? So she's really, during this period of the 90s, really looking very closely and doing essentially a kind of critique of Warhol. This is a work entitled Quadruple Yentl, My Elvis, of 1997. The reference here is to the movie, the 1983 movie with Barbara Streisand called Yentl, in which she played a man, a young man, she played a woman who dressed as a young man so that she could learn to read the Talmud, which was forbidden for women. So she took on the guise of being a man, cross-dresser. And that opens all sorts of connections with Warhol right there. And again, very much of Cass's interest to sort of delve into that and bring it forward. She subtitles it My Elvis, specifically referencing Elvis's various images, or Warhol's various images of Elvis in 63 and 64, in particular, the triple Elvis here, the silver Elvises. And then changing it, of course, so it shows Barbara Streisand holding a book rather than a pistol, raises questions, as I said, because of the role she plays of cross-dressing, raises questions which were raised in the early 60s about Warhol's great interest in Elvis and kind of from a homosexual point of view, and then the role that Elvis is playing as a cowboy, essentially, in this movie, just as Streisand is playing a role in Yentl. And so, again, for all the sort of what seems at first a direct kind of appropriation, there's oftentimes much more going on. One of the most intriguing and sort of mind-bending is Cass's altered image number 2 of 1995, which she's playing off of a series that Warhol had taken of himself. It was a collaborative work with Christopher Makos, called Altered Image, in which he dressed up as a woman with a female wig, but with a tie, exactly like this. Now, Cass dressed up, and so you basically have a woman dressing like a man who dressed like a woman, and sort of this unpacking that goes on about this, raising questions about gender and about sexuality and about one's outlook. You also find, again, all sorts of other aspects of Warhol's style or styles that do become appropriated by others. On the right is a poster that was part of it's called the Hurricane Poster Project from 2005, where a number of illustrators, graphic designers, and artists created prints that were then made into limited edition posters and sold to raise money for the relief efforts for people that had experienced Katrina. And this is by Michael Strasburger, who's one of the leads in a design firm called Modern Dog. And he, in a sense, was spoofing it, but in not a lighthearted way. It was a very ironic image as far as he was concerned, where this figure who is faceless, which says something about the survivors of Katrina in itself, but wearing a T-shirt, "I survived Katrina, and all I got was this lousy T-shirt." So a play upon that idea of souvenir T-shirts that people have. The linear style he uses with that sort of block color, flat color that's just put on out of register on top of the T-shirt is something, again, that really comes directly out of Warhol. And you find it a lot, particularly in advertising, on magazine covers. This is a Warhol oil stick drawing, quite large, about 30, almost 3 feet in height, 32, 34 inches in height of Jean Cocteau. Of 1893, which is a kind of source for something like that, which again has entered into popular consciousness. Warhol using a projector to project images and then doing these outline drawings, which are then, again, become part of the visual vocabulary that's available to graphic designers and others. There's long been a connection between Warhol and fashion, and he, very much involved with fashion and celebrities who were associated with fashion and so forth. And we saw early on, or I guess it was last week or the week before, this ad from 1974 on the left-hand side for Diane von Furstenberg's clothing. And with the image, a couple of the silkscreen images, prints of Marilyn Monroe, but advertising the clothing of this particular designer, who in fact was a good friend of Warhol's and was portrayed by him at least twice. Then in 2002, she releases a line of Warhol-inspired clothing, which feature an image, I think it's an image of herself based upon a Warhol image on one of the shirts, as you can see here. In 2008, she comes out with another line of Warhol-inspired clothes in collaboration with the Andy Warhol Estate, which has been very important in promoting Warhol and images like this. But here, you're looking at almost a 30-year period between these two images, and yet, in a way, nothing's really changed. He's still very much this presence in fashion. One of the most remarkable images I've seen connecting Warhol to fashion, and there's some really remarkable ones, I have to admit, is this image, which every time I see this, I think of Bjork's swan dress meets the floating head of the frightened, wigged Andy Warhol. It's a very bizarre work, and one I think you could only wear on special occasions. But this is from 2009. Warhol himself, as we saw when we were talking about advertisements, again, you could just go on and on about his appearance in advertisements, but he's used as a spokesperson. Or his image is used as a spokesperson for various, particularly fashion ads. The Gap, for example, began a campaign in 1990. I think it began in 1994, and Warhol was one of the first that image that they used. And again, Warhol has died 7 years earlier, so it's the estate that's allowing this to happen. This is an image, in fact, a photograph that was taken in 1949 by his then roommate in New York. They had just moved there together from Pittsburgh, Philip Perlstein, who goes on to become quite a well-known painter, obviously in his own right. But this image of the young Warhol in New York, and it's hard to read the ad, or the caption, the headline, you probably remember, it would say, "Andy Warhol wore khakis," or whoever was Picasso wore khakis, apparently, according to the Gap, because they had a picture of him. And they had all these artists that became essentially associated with their clothing. And again, Warhol's a really interesting choice because he was someone that had, you know, generated really mixed reactions. Some people thought he was so cool, some people thought he was, you know, Satan, and sort of every attitude in between. And, you know, if you want somebody as a spokesperson, you usually are going to play it fairly safe. But Warhol really has become somebody that is seen, I think, ultimately as, at this point, kind of safe hip and can be used. The Gap in 2008 had another use of Warhol in a lot of their stores where they had these enlarged photographs based on the 1963-64 very first photo booth photographs that Warhol had made of himself. This is from 2008, and this was both of these were national campaigns, which again keeps him out there in front of the public. In 2006, Barney's upscale clothing store in New York, Simon Doonan, who is their very creative window designer, had the idea at Christmas time of basically an ad campaign, but it was in their windows, called Happy Andy Warhol Days. And it was a very elaborate and in some ways not only complex, but quite very well done display of sort of Warhol-related materials and then various phases of Warhol. Warhol as, you know, the young illustrator on the left-hand side, where he's, you know, he's also... They really did a good job. Warhol is seen here not looking very much like Andy Warhol, even though it's based on a self-portrait. But he's seen as an illustrator. You see all his drawings on the wall. But his painting, or his shirt, looks like he's been doing an abstract expressionist painting. And that sort of him wanting to be a fine artist but still being an illustrator and negotiating that space between the two, which he was going to do until about 64. And then holding a photograph, an actual photograph, of Julia Warhol, his mother, who he was very close to during the 50s up until 72, just shortly before her death. And then on the right-hand side, it's Warhol, the party boy, essentially. And you find this sort of cube, illuminated cube as a head, this kind of Picasso-esque shirt that he often wore during this period and becomes identified with. It's really hard to see, I'm sorry. On the left is a street view, and you can barely... he's called Factory Boy. You can see that sign just... next to the image that's on the right-hand side. And there was a female figure with one of the women from the factory's portrait part of it. And then lots of details. I mean, there was something you really read over time. I assume it was successful, though you could spend all your time standing outside the store rather than actually going into it. A number of, as we've seen with Deborah Cass, artists have picked up on Warhol, different aspects of him, some stylistically, some more in terms of attitude, in terms of concept. Jeff Koons is an artist who in some ways has become as notorious as Warhol was, and in fact in some respects even more notorious or infamous, and someone who's been heavily criticized, at least earlier on in his career, criticized for his very commercial aspect to his art, also for his work, which certainly owed a debt to Duchamp, but also to Warhol as well, these common objects, these sort of flashy, pop-like, wet, dry, cleaning vacs that you see in these plexiglass vitrines and cases and mounted in a very kind of wonderful way. And on the right, an exhibition ad which provoked a whole lot of largely negative comment in 1988. It's not unusual at all from the 50s on for artists to design ads for their own exhibitions, but this seemed like he was just too commercial and not serious as an artist, but really more about the sort of celebrity-ness of it. That Koons came from a background of being a commodities broker for a while on Wall Street was continually brought up, and that when he worked at the membership desk at the MoMA in New York, he generated more membership than anyone ever had before. That kind of commercial part was played up over and over again, which he certainly fueled as well. But very much, I think, that celebrity part of it, connecting to Warhol and that sort of mood that Warhol generates, where the artist becomes a celebrity. More and more artists are licensing their work. I was reading somewhere recently that at a trade fair there were something like 300 artists who were trying to get licensed to, you know, sell their work and products related to their work. Even more, though, than Jeff Koons is Takashi Murakami. And his art and his absolutely blurring of the line between art and life and art and commerce and commodity, which is blurred anyway, but he really does that fully in his sort of empire that he's created, which involves animation and sculpture and painting and products and designs for Louis Vuitton and others. It's really quite remarkable. There was a large exhibition of his work traveling around. I happened to see it in L.A. at the Museum of Contemporary Art there in 2008, and it was really just a wonderful exhibition. The work is incredible, this sort of anime style in three dimensions. He calls it super flat because of the colors and that are flat but very, very intense and highly decorative work. There was, of course, a bookstore, which you expect to see, but you usually don't see skateboard decks for sale in that store, which is what you see hanging on the wall in the upper part, which are for sale and which were sold out. I mean, it was just amazing. They sold for about $250 each. And it's part of, again, what he does. What was even more amazing, and it raised some eyebrows and did receive some criticism, but it was sort of short-lived, I think, was in the very middle of the exhibition, you walked into what seemed to be a Louis Vuitton store. Everyone in there looked like they worked for Louis Vuitton. The sales girls, everyone was in black. The young man who was standing by the door looked like a ninja that could rip you apart in 2 seconds if you tried to take something. It was very impressive. And it was a Louis Vuitton store. It absolutely was. And they were selling works that Murakami had collaborated with in designing for Louis Vuitton. They were all high-end items, but embedded right in the middle of the exhibition. There was no kind of distinction made, except you realized you were in this space that, you know, gee, this looks a lot like a store. It is a store. It's not like the Prada store outside of Marfa, which is sort of hermetically sealed. It was an actual store where you could spend, you know, $50,000 if you chose to. It's a really fascinating concept because it partly, of course, owes to Warhol, but it also goes back even slightly earlier to Claus Oldenburg, who in 1961 had a piece called The Store, in which he rented a store on the Lower East Side in Manhattan, and he, for a month, created works of art there. It was a studio, but he also sold them, and he set it up like a store, and he put prices like $39.99 for this sculpture and things like that. So it was a store, it was a gallery, it was a studio. Here, it's really a store. It's a franchise. Right in the middle of an exhibition. You know, it's not, we all expect when we get to the end of particularly a blockbuster exhibition, you're going to be greeted by a store. And you've got to sort of work your way through that. But this was right in the middle. No pretense about keeping you waiting till the end. A couple of examples of Murakami's work. Again, it's not directly stylistically related to Warhol, although he deals a lot in his installations with wallpaper, which is something that Warhol also dealt with. And in the exhibition upstairs where the self-portraits are, you've got that wonderful, those two walls that have wallpaper. And when the large paintings of Mao are shown by Warhol, they're usually against Mao wallpaper, and the flowers that are upstairs from the permanent collection here have also been shown as wallpaper. So you find that decorative aspect in Murakami's work, and then this, because of the skull, I thought was, or the skeletal image, I thought was kind of interesting. Very typical of his work is the panda that you see here, these sort of fun, childlike objects. In this case, though, standing on a Louis Vuitton chest, which is an actual chest that it's on. He also, and I think this is clearly a nod to Warhol, recently has designed, and Louis Vuitton has marketed this camouflage jacket. This is from 2008. It's a wonderful kind of jacket, I think, because it's a reversible jacket. So if you turn it inside out, you actually camouflage the camouflage. No one can see it, which is, I think it's very clever, but really, in part, playing on Warhol. What you can't see in this image is, in fact, the Louis Vuitton logo monogram that is all over that jacket, as well as the camouflage. It's not terribly well camouflaged. These two images, I think, I brought them in because they, again, sort of represent the range of possible reactions to Warhol and why he seems to live on in people's minds. One is, you know, he was this hip partygoer. He had the factory. He made films. He knew all these stars. You know, it seemed like party, 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 Studio 54 and all of that. So the Andy Warhol Museum advertised, this from 2000, a flyer they had up around, all over Pittsburgh, Friday happy hour. The implication, you know, is Andy Warhol's going to be there, which, you know, he's not. Or else he's really going to look scary. But the idea that, you know, and it's a triple image, as you see, of Warhol, and a sort of a benign party image of Warhol. So that kind of cool, hip side of him is played up. And then the other is the businessman. In the 70s, Warhol announces that, you know, art is a business, business is art. He's in the art of business art. And Andy Warhol Incorporated, the brand, the market. It also, the subheadline says the Brillo box scandal that had to do with what apparently are not authentic Brillo boxes. Much to, it shouldn't be to anyone's surprise, it's not real hard to make a fake Brillo box of Andy Warhol. And particularly, they had a problem in Sweden at the Museum of Modern Art there about a number of the boxes not being authentic Warhol boxes. But Warhol Incorporated, this empire, essentially, this idea of him being astute, being someone who you know, could tell which way the wind was blowing in terms of what's going on. We were talking about that in the gallery and how works of art can, you look at them differently under different contexts. And probably up until a week ago, you would walk by his a painting of Vesuvius erupting and not maybe give it a second look. But now with what's happened in Iceland, you sort of think, oh, gee, you know, he knew about this. This is another artist who's, I think, done a wonderful kind of parody of Warhol, along with others. But I think the linchpin is really Warhol in this. Douglas Gordon is primarily known as a video artist. He's done some really extraordinary videos, particularly using older Hollywood films and creating these plays on a single word or a scream or a phone ringing. They're really amazing videos. He's a Scottish artist, a Scotsman who's won the Turner Prize. Here he's seen in 1996, it's a self-portrait, as the title indicates, as Kurt Cobain, as Andy Warhol, as Myra Hindley, and as Marilyn Monroe. They're all the same in a sense. Again, sort of in part playing off of Warhol when he began to cross-dress and when he began to, you know, wear disguises. And, of course, the wig was essentially a disguise from the 60s on, or part of his outfit. Myra Hindley is maybe not so well known to most people here in the United States. She was a notorious murderess from the 1960s, who, along with her companion, killed at least five children. And it was a terrible event, and she was reviled and ultimately died in prison. Marcus Harvey, it would have been about 1997, because it was in the Sensation exhibition in the Royal Academy of Art in England when it opened, had created a huge image of Myra Hindley, black and white. And when you looked very closely, you realized that this large portrait, which was, you know, configured like this essentially, but in black and white, was actually not made of paint strokes, but handprints of children. That he had arranged for them to create this work. It was very disturbing work, and people were horrified by it and very outrageous. So part of, and it was painted right about 96 because it was shown in 97, part of what Douglas is doing is also commenting on that negative celebrityness. You've got Kurt Cobain, who commits suicide, Marilyn Monroe, who commits suicide. So it, in a way, for all its kind of humor, it's a very dark image in its own way. I always like this cover from Fort Worth Weekly in 2003. What the hell? This cowboy, this is cowboy and culture in Fort Worth, I guess, mixing it up and you know, wondering what's going on with this kind of art. But what, for our purposes, what I find really striking is that, you know, of all the works that could have been selected from this museum or any of the Carter or the Kimball, it's the image of Marilyn Monroe. And again, it's that kind of power of that iconic image and the well-knownness of Andy Warhol. He may not know what's going on and wonder what the heck it's all about, but Warhol, as I say, continues to live on in children's books. This is a book from 2001, which is about Lisa and Gaspar, who are based in France, and they come to New York to visit Uncle Harrison, who has a penthouse apartment, like all Americans do, and on the wall you see Warhol's soup can and Marilyn Monroe. And again, of all the possibilities to put in an illustration like this, an illustration that, you know, is talking about the United States and talking about New York, so it's about America, and the thinking undoubtedly is, what could be more American than these two pop icons of Andy Warhol? Or this is from 2004, Bloom County, a cartoon strip. It's hard to read, but I'm going to focus on the panel that's in the upper left, which is this one, where on the wall is Marilyn. In the newspaper, it's Michael Jackson. So you have, you know, these twin iconic images. But, you know, you have to ask yourself, why is it? Well, it has to do that this image keeps showing up. It has to do with its become an iconic feature of our visual culture, and it becomes a signifier of modern art. It's a signifier of Warhol, but in a way it even is beyond Warhol. It's just simply a signifier of popular culture, the high art, even though it's in a home like this. And then I wanted to end with this image. As I said, Warhol would have probably loved surfing the net and seeing what you could find, because it's really quite amazing. And this is this guy's 15 minutes. I'm giving him a minute and a half, but it might as well be 50 minutes. I have no idea. This is what's great about the internet. I have no idea who this is. But this, I came across this, and he's at a exhibition of Warhol's work in Japan. It's being advertised with a Marilyn Monroe image, which is appropriate. He's holding up, it's a bag, a shopping bag, that says Andy Warhol on it. It then has a dollar sign, which is great, followed by everyone's going to be famous for 15 minutes in the future. So it all is there. So thank you very much for your attention. I appreciate it, and enjoy your fame. If anyone does have any questions, I did end a little bit early, and had any questions, I'd be glad to try to answer them. Yes?
Last week you mentioned sort of the finality of the reputation photograph, or the reputation painting, and so on, the repetitions here tonight, the 16 Marilyns and all of that. Mm-hmm. And you and others talk about, well, is that the way to dull celebrity or to celebrate celebrity? But in fact, how do you then take that and play it against the 125 Jesus ones? What's going on?
Well, I think it raises the same question, the 112 Jesuses. Actually, I should defer to Jeremy Arnold and Ashley Stull, who are in the audience, two of my students who wrote about that work, really put them on the spot. But it raises the same questions, I think, through the replication of Jesus' image, it becomes iconic, but does it also become, in a sense, kind of just part of the visual environment? You don't notice it. I was thinking about how people used to have, I don't see it very often today at all, but people used to have, little plastic sculptures of St. Christopher on their dashboard. You didn't notice it after a while. Whoops, sorry. So I think it raises the same question about, does repetition enhance something, or does it dull it? It does both, I think. At certain times, I think we respond to it that way. There's also something in that piece in particular, because it's so massive, that is wonderfully environmental, and sort of Jesus is all around you, in a sense, all these various Jesuses. You may remember the Sugimoto show that was here, and there was a wonderful large photograph of the 1,000 Buddha figures. And that's the only other work I can think that's what I was telling the class, which is really amazing. And that's a striking image, too. But I think, it is, it can go either way or both ways. And I always think that's part of what pop art is doing. It's a both and situation rather than an either or situation. And that's a very kind of what was at one point called postmodernist point of view, there's that openness to it, and it can be one and the same, just like Ethel's skull can be seen 36 different ways.
Do the two students agree with what you're saying? We'll put them on the spot.
Jeremy, what do you think?
Yeah, I would agree. It's definitely, I agree.
He wants to be a graduating senior, so he's agreeing.
The other thing, I've brought up another interesting point, that it could be like a mantra, visually speaking, seeing an image, the same image over and over again, and that could be enhancing of the meaning of that image of Christ. But then again, yeah, we also see that image, that particular image of Christ in the Last Supper, so much in our culture today that it could be a commentary on the overuse, the overproduction, seeing that so many times.
You also, because he's taken that image from the Leonardo painting, and even though he's isolated it, but then replicated it, but you can't help but not see it in a different way. And you might, I mean, somebody, it's happened, it happened in class, somebody would ask, you know, where's that image from? Not recognizing it because it's out of that context of that larger scene. And so it makes you look at it in a slightly a different way. The other thing that I find very intriguing about that work, Ashley, did you want to say?
No, I'm
good. Okay, you're good, you're good. Intriguing about that work is I'm hard-pressed to think of other Warhol compositions, particularly that are portraits, that are cut off the way that one is on its right side. The image is almost halved, not quite. You find that in some of his soup can paintings, like 200 soup cans and so forth. But I don't think you see that in the portraits. So that's a little bit. And what strikes me about that is it gives you the sense that it's endless. It could just keep going. That this is just a slice of something even bigger. Yes.
Have you heard there's foul play involved in his death?
Oh, Well, I don't think it's probably one of the, I'm sure there are all sorts of conspiracy theories. It's probably one of the things that isn't a conspiracy theory. It's pretty well known that it was a botched, not necessarily a botched operation, but the aftercare was botched. And in fact, the estate sued the hospital and they settled out of court. And so they pretty much admitted that. I mean, it was a routine gallbladder surgery, and you know, he fully expected to be back at work in 2 days, it you know, just was not, the care wasn't what it should have been. Yeah.
So was he like vibrant until the end?
Well, he was in a great deal of pain, which is why he had that gallbladder operation, and he put it off because, you know, he had been pronounced dead in a hospital in 1968 after he was shot, and he wasn't real anxious to go to a hospital. So he did put it off, but it should not have gone the way it did.
I've noticed recently that a number of people have died from routine gallbladder.
Oh, really?
Operations. Maybe I've just sensitized to look
right,
at
right, sense of the Warhol.
It seems to be that's game. You know.
Another lesson we can learn from any Warhol.
Don't go
into a fire operation. Anything else? Well, thank you all very much for coming.